This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, open year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenbloom. My dad, Harry Rosenbloom, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's theme is youth. We'll have a report on how migrant children separated from their families at the U.S. border are being housed and fed.
Right now, what we're very worried about is just the influx of kids created by this zero tolerance policy.
We'll also look into a program that's ensuring free summer meals for kids are only a text message away.
Summer is the hungriest time of year for a kid who may not have that safety net of school meals.
We discover a new home economics curriculum.
I'm not trying to raise a generation of chefs. I'm trying to raise a generation of nourishers who can nourish themselves.
And we meet a teen chef who's talked his way into several of New York's top kitchens.
I never try and be, like, annoying about it, but I really want to get my foot in the door.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenbloom, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. As you may have heard just before the episode, that was in fact my daughter Moxie talking about Heritage Radio and our fundraiser, our membership drive this summer. So please donate. We have 35 plus weekly shows here on the station, and that means there are thousands and thousands. I think we've done over 10,000 episodes that you can listen to. So, you know, not only can you listen every single day to a different show, but, you know, please think about donating to keep us on the air. Wanted to mention an event I have going on here in Brooklyn tomorrow, July 17th. Please join me and my fellow HRN host, Michael Harlan Turkell, who hosts The Food Scene, for an event called Sumo Stew. We have done Sumo Stew now, more than 20 times. It's an extravaganza of food, drink, and of course, round after round of sumo wrestling coming to you as close to live as possible from Japan. You can check out more at sumostew.com. Today's theme of Feast Your Ears is Humaris Americanus. How did this peasant food become regarded as such a delicacy? When we see lobster on the menu of a restaurant with cloth napkins, it seems so decadent and a premium delicacy. Yet lobster was once the food of peasants and prisoners, reported to have been so prevalent on the main coastline that at low tide you could just scoop them off the beach. They look like giant bugs and they live on the bottom of the sea in the cool waters off the coast of New England and Maritime Canada. A thriving fishery in Maine that supports an economy and is largely self-governed is a model of sustainable fisheries. We've seen in recent years a proliferation of lobster in restaurants all over, serving lobster rolls in a variety of preparations, and I'll give you my favorite version later in the episode. But there's an absolutely thriving business in New York's Chelsea Market where the Lobster Place serves thousands, I'm guessing, of steamed lobsters every day to tourists and locals alike who pick and slurp the meat from the shells in what is about as far from a fine dining experience as I can imagine. But the succulence of the meat and a sense of decadence drives them to it in droves. Steamed is the way I eat lobster most often, though in recent years I have taken to splitting them in half and grilling them, which, if you don't overcook them, is a spectacular way to go. It's very hard to eat lobster from the shell and not get juice all over yourself, and as such, I often chuckle when I see whole lobster on the menu of fancier restaurants and see folks in fine clothes trying to carefully take apart a claw to get to the meat. It's much more fun, in my opinion, to gather around a table covered in old newspaper and just tear into them. I have a process personally by which I eat them that's been pretty much the same since I was a kid. My dad thought it was cute that at age 5 or 6 I would order a lobster in a restaurant. He wouldn't order an entree because invariably I wouldn't finish it and he'd have a soup or a salad and then finish my lobster. At about age 9, I ordered a lobster and proceeded to eat the whole thing. He had to order something else from that day on. My guests today represent two pieces of the supply chain that bring these delicious and, let's face it, weird-looking food to our tables. Chef Jimmy Papadopoulos is the man behind Belmore in Chicago and cooks lobster, among other things, all the time. And lobsterman Chris Welch, who's been on the water hauling traps since he was in first grade, who goes out every day, all year round, to pull them up, I guess except today, because you're in Brooklyn. Thanks, guys, for joining me.
Oh, no, a pleasure to have us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Chris, you know, you have been on the water for like 2.5 decades then.
Yeah, so a lot of people, I'm 30 now, and it's hard for a lot of people to fathom that I've been doing this since I was 6 or 7 years old. I started going with my grandfather, and I took his business over when he no longer could do it, and I've been at it ever since. It's a way of life.
So pretty much, and you fish year-round.
That's right, yep. So in the wintertime, we go on the days that the weather will allow us.
Sure.
And this time of year, we fish pretty much 6 days a week. In June, July, and August, we can't fish on Sundays. That's a state rule.
Hmm.
And so we get a day to spend with our family.
Oh, that's nice. So, you know, what does a normal day look like? I mean, I imagine you're up before dawn.
Yeah, most days I start not crazy early, but I get up around 3:45, 4 o'clock.
I think to a lot of us, we would look at that and say that's pretty crazy early. I would imagine that Jimmy's sometimes leaving the kitchen about 3:45 a.m.
for bedtime
after like a
for
Saturday
me
night.
Is yeah. 1-2 in the morning. Yeah. So
I'll get up this time of year. We're leaving the dock around 5. We have a little bit shorter ride to our gear this time of year because we're fishing more inshore. And we get to see a sunrise nearly every day. It makes your job just a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, the coast of Maine is so beautiful that I imagine that that's a really nice highlight.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And then we'll fish either hauling, you know, we can have 800 traps in the state of Maine. That's what each lobster fisherman is allowed to fish up to. And I usually do it in a 3-day rotation and a 2-day rotation if need be. So we'll fish through, and this time of year we're home by 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Got it.
Whereas in the fall, we're fishing a little further offshore. We usually leave in the dark and come home in the dark.
Right, right. And then are you holding your, when you bring the lobsters back in, are you selling them immediately at the dock? Or are you holding them and selling them based on, you know, based on need and based on the market?
So I sell every day. It's a fresh caught lobster. It's hand selected day boats. We go out, we catch what we catch that day. When I come in, I sell them to a retailer. Or wholesaler, I guess you could call it, and they distribute them to different places. Like, we're in a process now of trying to figure out how to get them to Jimmy from
right,
me.
Sure.
And so every day that we go, they're fresh caught, hand-picked, day boats, and that's how it is. So.
And you know, I mean, I would imagine most people who are listening probably know this, but, I mean, lobster generally is distributed live.
That's
in
right.
This country.
Right. Yep.
There are places and people who are picking it and freezing it or, you know, that kind of thing, or even frozen fresh. I've seen now Greenhead Lobster. I think they're out of Deer Isle, maybe, up that way. But they're now distributing a fresh frozen lobster tails and claw meat.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about that end of the business. I'm still trying to learn and pick up on it. So there's a lot more for me to figure out. But as for what we do, we sell a live product every single day.
Yeah. So, Jimmy, you are from Illinois.
Yeah.
You're a chef in Chicago.
Correct.
You know, tell me about your relationship to lobster.
So, born and raised, you know, in the center of the nation outside of Chicago, you don't really get exposed to the coast much. You don't get exposed to it. But growing up as a kid, I remember thumbing through my mom's, you know, old Frugal Gourmet cookbooks. And I remember seeing, like, you know, bright red lobsters on tables and stuff. And for us out there, you know, there wasn't a lot of seafood restaurants. But growing up, we'd go to Red Lobster every once in a while. And I remember maybe being 7, 8 years old and marveling at the tank filled with the lobsters.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see that growing up. And then when I became a chef, my very first introduction actually working with it was at a hotel. We had this pasta dish that would sell like crazy. But we'd bring in live Maine lobsters and we would clean them, like, you know, just constantly it was a pasta dish. So for me, you know, working with lobster is something that's kind of come throughout my career. But be able to get out on a boat with Chris and see the entire experience and where it actually comes from is something that, you know, was on my bucket list pretty much.
Sure.
You know, to go eat a lobster straight out of the ocean.
Yeah.
So this whole experience, you know, with the trap the table thing was just mind-numbingly awesome. So.
And then, you know, do you feel now that you are able to take that experience and translate that to the table and to the diners at Belmore?
100%. And Chris and I were talking, how do I get this? You know, a lot of times you call your seafood company in the middle of the country, in Chicago, there's multiple seafood distributors and companies, and to Chris's point, he is a sole proprietor of his ship, of his boat. He brings his lobster in, sells it to market, and then who knows where it goes.
Right.
So figuring out that chain and how to get Chris's lobster in my restaurant would be something that would be, amazing. You literally can say, I was on this man's boat pulling traps with him, pulling lobsters right out of the cold waters of Maine, and it's here to serve to you. So, I mean, that's something that is exciting as well.
Yeah, and the ability then to connect that diner with Chris and with the process and with the fishery. I mean, I think it's, the more, one of the things I think that is so interesting in food right at this moment is that we do have access to knowing these stories and understanding these stories. 10, 15 years ago, you might have been able to ask some people about it, but it would have been very hard to find the information or to find the fishermen from, if you were a chef in Chicago.
And still today, even Chicago, I mean, we know where we're getting corn from. I know who we're buying turnips from up there, who my beef comes from, who my chicken comes from. But a lot of the times fish tend to be, seafood in particular tends to be a little bit of a lost kind of connection for us.
Right.
So to be able to pick something like lobster and say, the source is quite amazing. So,
yeah,
we're almost trying to brand it as a trap to table. So it's something that if you can put a face on where it's coming from, a lot of people really enjoy that. I think it's similar to the, farm to table type.
Of course.
Thing.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty cool opportunity that we're trying to get in on right now. So,
well, and I think understanding too, that, that fish is, I feel like fish is in this weird moment where there is, so much press about the bad practices in fishing.
Correct.
And consumers are becoming more aware. People are asking where their beef is coming from, where their turnips, where their corn, whether it's GMO, all of this stuff. And they're starting to ask those questions about fish. And so it is so important to recognize that, sustainable and responsible fishing is not new. And that there are places that are doing it, but it's a matter of really understanding where that's coming from. I mean, so, Chris, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And as a fisherman, there are lobsters up and down the coast. I mean, as far south as Long Island and even, Jersey even, and then all the way up into Canada. And each state kind of has different regulations. But as I understand it, Maine is one of the most carefully regulated fisheries, and it's really regulated by the lobstermen.
So one thing that's really amazing about our industry is years ago, our forefathers, I guess you could call them the gentlemen that came long before us, realized that if we kept keeping nearly everything, they wouldn't last.
Yeah.
So what they did is they put in some stuff, simple things like they put we have a measure, or some people call it a gauge, and every lobster we come at gets measured, and we have an oversize and an undersize. So if the shell is under 3 1/4 inches, it goes back in the ocean to grow to, maybe catch another day. And on the same hand, if it's over 5 inches, it goes back. And that's to kind of protect the breeding stock. Another thing we do is on the females, we put a notch in one of their flippers. And what that does, that tells the next lobsterman or me next time I catch it that lobster is able to be an egg-bearing lobster. So that's protecting our breeding stock. We do other things like we have escape vents in the traps, which gives the small lobsters a chance to come and go as they please. They come in, they eat, and they leave. And there's all kinds of things we've done like that. We have a number of traps we can fish up to. There's no more than that. Every lobsterman's even in that thing. And so those are some of the sustainable practices that we do. And you can't really get a good appreciation for it until you see it. So I was explaining to Jimmy, and it was, I think, mind-blowing for him to see how many go back into the ocean to catch another day.
Truthfully blown away. I mean, we got out there, and you'd see these traps come up, and, you start hauling a couple, maybe one has five in them, and then you get this trap that comes up, and there's 25 lobsters teeming in there.
Right.
And literally going through, engaging each ones, and finding ones that have notches in their tails, and you're like, oh, well, that's a beautiful lobster, but that one goes back because she's an egg-bearing.
Right.
And that... You think of sustainability and you think of how hard these guys' jobs are, and then look at these traps and what they actually pull up. They're keeping 5% of what they're catching, maybe at max. Is that a good...
Yeah, there's times of the year when, coming right up, when the new shells start to come out after they've molted, we may catch 10 or 12 to a trap and get to keep them all.
Right.
But in the spring and when the smaller lobsters are around before they begin their molt process... There's times you can have 25 or 30 in a trap and not keep a one, which is it's a good thing. So we're looking for those different things to sustain the industry, to put them back in, to keep things going. And these are obviously working because in the 80s, caught maybe 30 million pounds a year. In the last few years, we've caught around 100 to 120 million pounds. Yeah. So something we're doing has been working.
And I think it's really important to also like to note that that is not because the technology of the catching has gotten better.
Right.
It's not like in some fisheries where we've gotten better and we're just like tearing everything out of the ocean. It's practices to manage that
fishery. So very little has changed. I mean, we used to use wooden lobster traps and we've moved into wire lobster traps. And maybe a lot of people used to use a little bit smaller traps. Now they're using bigger. And I think the ideas in those are just strictly the more room in the trap, the more lobsters that they can hold.
Yeah.
But for the numbers to, you know, continuously grow, continuously look good, we're in a good spot.
Yeah, I mean, I even read one report that that said the first time, I think it was probably in like the 80s, maybe in the early 90s, that they sent down a video camera to look at a lobster trap. They actually were amazed that lobsters were actually not really getting trapped.
Yeah.
Like they were kind of moving in and out, and then when you pulled it up, it just was however many happened to be in there at the moment.
I tell people all the time, I say, we catch what's in there when we haul it.
Right.
It's a revolving door. I mean, we try to make it as efficient as we can to keep everything in there that crawls in, but if they want to leave, they more or less can.
Right.
I mean, they come in, get their free meal, and they go.
Yeah. Well, and so in that way, it's almost like I hadn't ever thought about it till you just mentioned that and mentioned that there's the sort of escape for the smaller lobsters. I mean, it is almost in a way like a cross between both trapping and ranching.
And farming, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, the lobstermen are providing a food source to keep the lobsters and to keep the stocks going, which I think is really, you know.
What seems to be a popular question amongst people my age is when you haven't seen them in a while, they say, what do you do for a living? I just tell them I'm an ocean farmer.
Yeah.
And just let them think on it for a while.
What else do you find in the traps? I mean, there's got to be bycatch, right? Other things get in there?
Yeah, once in a while we'll catch things. We catch a lot of crabs.
Sure.
Tell them about the
Jonah crabs.
What was the fish that we caught, that I caught?
We caught a small mudhake.
Okay.
He swum his way in there and...
I was at the stern of the boat, which is the back of the boat, for those of you who are not boat savvy.
Now, to mind you, Jimmy's taking this all in, and
this is my first time on a lot. I don't know. So, anyways, I'm at the back of the boat.
He's having quite a time.
And I'm back there, and I'm talking to his stern man, and we're talking. And then all of a sudden, Chris goes, "Hey, Jimmy!" And I look up, and there's this fish, maybe 20 inches, flying and flopping in the air, coming my way, live fish. And I put my hands up, and my face, face puckered up, and thankfully I caught the fish. And they were all cracking up.
We friendly refer to that as a hake toss.
Yeah.
So it's usually a surprise event. Sometimes we'll catch sea robins, which is like a scalpin, some people call them too. They're a little bit different. But most of the time you catch lobsters and some crabs and things like that. But for the main part, it's pretty efficient, and we don't see a ton of everything else. So it's
and
nice.
Do you and do you keep any? I mean, are the crabs? Do the crabs have any value back at the dock?
We can keep them. Our license allows us to. In our area, we don't have much of a market for them.
Got it.
And when the lobsters are hot and heavy, we don't see any crabs.
Because they're probably fighting
the lobsters.
Yeah, I don't know if they don't get along or what. I haven't talked to them about it, but it just seems to they don't usually come together.
I mean, in those 20 traps we pulled when we went out, we found what, two crab maybe?
Yeah,
that was
two or three.
So it was two crab, two fish.
So
and that was and this was a very slow time of year too.
Right.
So.
Right.
So things for us are really about to start picking up. I suspect when we go home, we'll be right in the thick of things.
Yeah.
And the new shell season will be in full swing. So it'll be a great time. That's my favorite time of year. So
cool. So let's talk a little bit about that. So, in having spent a bunch of time in Maine, there's a very big distinction between a hard shell and a new shell. And both in price when you go to buy it and in how you have to open it, the hard shell lobster, as the name would suggest, the shell is incredibly hard. I mean, you need a hammer sometimes or like a heavy set of nutcrackers or, vice grips to crack them open. And new shells often, if they're really new, you can just tear them apart with your fingers.
Yeah, that makes for ease of eating. I mean, there's a lot of things different here. So how a lobster grows is a molting process. The lobster will grow inside his old shell. And once he gets to the point where that shell on the inside is too big for the one on the outside, he goes into a molting process. So the line down the center of the carapace, which is the main shell, will actually crack open.
Oh, wow.
And the lobster will crawl his way out. When they do this, they are super, super soft. Like, you can't even pick them up. They're almost run through your fingers. Now, from what I understand, they'll crawl out of their shell and they'll actually eat their old shell. It helps them strengthen up and give them to the next thing. So in that same process, their meat is no longer cramped tightly into that shell. They're in a new shell. They have a little bit of room to expand. There's some more room in there for some juices and the sweetness. So you get a little bit different textured meat, which I think is a lot sweeter. It has a better texture to me. It's not as maybe not chewy, but
sure.
I don't know
how to explain. Dense. I mean, yeah, dense. In my opinion, this is my first time ever experiencing new shell. I've heard about it and I've never actually had it, but being in Maine and experiencing it firsthand, the one thing that I noted that was a stark difference was the sweetness of the lobster and as well as the texturally. Yeah. And you could imagine the lobster literally just shed his old shell and he's growing into a new one.
Right.
So the meat is going through that growth period and you could literally feel the texture change. You know, sometimes you eat like a mature hard lobster and they're still sweet, they're still delicious, but it's got a firmer, more springy texture to it, yeah. Correct? And then when you eat a new shell, you'll feel this extremely just tender, sweet lobster meat. So it was very... you know, it was amazing. When I grabbed one, you know, Chris told me, he's like, oh, you know, the shells are softer. And I didn't realize how soft they were. Right. And I pinched the claw with just maybe like a medium pressure at all. Like, you know, something that you barely feel. And I cracked the shell. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, crap, I cracked the shell. He's like, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Just let's cook them.
So we see a lot of them, I mean, every day. So the thing of it is they have such a difference. Like when you cook them, they're different colors. I mean, they come out, the old shells or hard shells look a little bit... darker. A little bit rougher, you know. Yeah. They've lived the life on the bottom and they've dragged around. They got little scars on their shells and a little darker. Whereas when you cook a new shell, it comes out. It's bright red. I say it's a beautiful looking lobster. But when they come up in the traps, we can spot them instantly. Just the color, it's a robust, bright. Underneath is like an orange. Their top is just vibrant. There's something to see.
Yeah,
you could see them right here on the table too. I mean, we brought, you could see the difference between the shells.
Yeah, so we brought some old shells and some new shells here to kind of do a sample on the different tastes.
Awesome.
Who doesn't like to have lobster?
I'm not going to say no. Well, we'll take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors, and when we come back, we can tell you all about how great it tastes. And you can listen to us eat it.
Is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays year-round. On Thursday, August 23rd, Brooklyn Botanic Garden will host the Beer and Bocce Benefit, a one-of-a-kind garden party featuring lawn games, live music, and unlimited beer tastings by some of Brooklyn's top beer makers. Proceeds from the Beer and Bocce Benefit provide essential support for the garden's educational and community programs. And mark your calendars for the annual Chili Pepper Festival on Saturday, September 29th. New York's hottest fall tradition will set the garden ablaze with scorching bands from around the world, dozens of fiery food artisans, and hours of chili chocolate debauchery. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and just tuning in, today I've got Chef Jimmy Papadopoulos from Belmore in Chicago with me, and Lobsterman Chris Welch, who's from Kennebunk, Maine, and we're talking all about lobster. We're talking about eating lobster. We're talking about catching lobster. So tell me about what we have here on the table. We've got two lobsters, and we've got some meat to taste, right?
So what we've done, we brought an old shell lobster and a new shell lobster. Now, they're very different, but they're very the same. So the new shell, he'd crawled out of his old shell. He'd molted in the process, left his old shell behind. And now he's a brighter looking lobster. He has a sweet taste. So on one side, we have some of the old shell meat to try and the new shell meat. Yeah. Just to kind of give you a free sample for one, but also a chance to taste the texture difference right in front of you and the flavor as well.
Awesome.
So I'll pass a little out to you.
Thank you. And now you're referring to them as he. Are these both in fact male lobsters?
I'd actually, looking at it right now, there's probably one of each, without flipping them over. So, when you turn them over here, We taught Jimmy when he was a lobsterman with us. I'm wondering if he remembers. Maybe
I can
he
tell
can
you
kind of,
right now. Okay,
so maybe he can point it out.
The new shell lobster on the right, you can tell right up here with these two flippers.
Yep.
They're a little bit thicker and firmer. That's a male.
Yep.
Okay, and then over here, the larger hard shell, the older hard shell, she has much thinner ones, so that's going to be a female.
Got it. Yeah, so to tell everybody out there, when you turn the lobster over, the little flipperettes that are closest to the body on the underside of the tail, like Jimmy said, if they're harder and a little more pointy, then it's a male lobster, and if they're softer, then it's a female lobster. But this obviously is a female who has not been part of the breeding stock yet.
Yeah, so she...
Her tail wasn't notched and she was able to be caught.
That's right. Or if she was, she was never caught during
right.
that time.
Right, right.
So what I had forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about protecting our breeding stock, if that lobster comes up covered in eggs or in any eggs at all, one even, we are asked by the state of Maine or asked by the fishermen before us to put these in to make a notch in the first flipper in from the right side, the second flipper in from the right side. Now, if that comes up in the trap and there's anything wrong with that flipper, I put the lobster back in the ocean for next time.
Yep.
And that'll grow out over time as that lobster molts and sheds its shell and changes.
Sure. The damage
it'll eventually grow out.
Yeah.
So that lobster is not damaged for life. It's actually protecting that lobster's life for the time
sure.
being. So this one here has not molted this year, and it was not egg-bearing at any time when someone caught it and was able to see that it was egg-bearing.
Right. So Jimmy, you know, since we're tasting these, you know, these lobsters, I mean, the hard shell, like you said, is like a little bit more like springy and dense.
Right.
And the new shell is a little bit sweeter. I mean, it definitely has like that, you know, the meat is softer.
Right. And if you think about it, I mean, just from a standpoint of the lobster growing, going through a growth spurt, basically, mm-hmm. it's going to be much more tender. The meat has a much sweeter flavor to it,
yeah.
and it still has the same salinity and that same lobster quality yeah. you get of any other Maine lobster, whether it's a hard shell. But the new shells, specifically, their textures is what I find super remarkable.
Yeah. So, do you have different dishes then that you would like? If you're getting in lobsters, you know, from Chris, and you're getting hard shells, would you use those for a different dish than the
Absolutely.
New shells?
Yeah. I mean, you look at the two of them, and you think of the. If you think of something like a new shell lobster, I'd want something much more nuanced and delicate to kind of showcase that beautiful texture and sweetness. You know, and you could either way, whether you're serving a new shell or a hard shell Maine lobster, but the new shells in particular, I feel, in my opinion, just having tasted them, I think they would lend amazing to getting a little bit of a char on the grill.
Mm.
You know, kissing them on over some hardwood charcoal so you get the flavor, as well as a little bit of texture on the exterior of the lobster to kind of counterbalance that beautiful softness.
Sure.
So for me, it's just, and what I loved about the new shell is the sweetness.
Yeah.
The flavor is intense. It's very sweet, very full lobster flavor.
Yeah.
So the thing too with the new shell is with there being a little bit of extra room in the shell that hasn't grown into, they've built their own brine. So a lot of times when people will pick these lobsters, they'll suck the juice right out of the shells because it is such a sweet, flavorful, succulent taste.
Yeah.
And it, a lot of times the people that are, you know, shelling these lobsters or picking them get the best right out of them before they share them with anybody else,
right?
So
I definitely, yeah. So earlier I mentioned, like, when I was a kid, I definitely had a process for eating lobster. And I definitely, you know, for a long time always said I really preferred eating lobster in Maine. You know, have friends and acquaintances who are lobstermen, so like just go down to the dock and buy it when they're coming in. Or last year, a friend of mine took me out with my kids, and that was a really great experience. The kids got to see the lobsters coming right out of the trap. But I would always, and I'm curious to hear from you, Chris, like how you grew up eating them. I would always eat the claws first, and then I would eat the tail, and then I would suck all the meat out of the legs, and then I would take the meat out of the body. That was always my process.
So growing up, we didn't eat a lot of lobsters. I fished with my grandfather, and he just...
Well, you don't want to get high on your own supply, right?
He had an old adage that he didn't want to eat his profit.
Yeah, exactly.
And and he wasn't a huge seafood fan, period. But I've always eaten them right out of the shell. I mean, that's the traditional Maine way. You crack them, and you eat them.
Yep.
No butter, no anything, just the way they are. So, but now, when we have lobsters at home a little more, my wife loves to have a lobster roll.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I'll pick them out for her and eat all the knuckles, which drives her crazy because that's her favorite part. But that's the reward for doing all the work.
Right.
And
sure.
Put them into a lobster roll with a little bit of mayonnaise and maybe some butter. And just eat them up. I mean, that's the simple.
I mean, a lobster roll is such a good. I mean, a lobster roll is like, to me, is like the most delicious sandwich of summer.
Oh. And it's the perfect expression for the lobster. Yeah. You know, I mean, that said, it's nothing else. It's unadulterated. It's delicious. Yeah.
It's like a lot of people like fresh, like cucumber and tomato sandwiches. I mean, this is Maine as that gets.
That's a really good way to describe it. The thing that I also find amazing is the proliferation of that, right? I mean, now you see lobster rolls at McDonald's. You see lobster rolls. I mean, there's, you know, I think there's at least three lobster roll specific food companies in New York City.
Right.
That didn't ever used to exist in the past. I mean, in the past, it was a product that really, if you wanted a lobster roll, you had to at least get as far north as Connecticut before that was even like an option.
So having grown up in Maine and I live a simple way of life, and when I cook, it's pretty simple. But I don't know if it might take Jimmy off hand here, but last couple weeks ago when we cooked together, or he did all the cooking and I ate the lobster meat, he made a dish where he'd season the lobsters, and it was a tempura, I believe.
Well, yeah, it was fried. Yeah, and it's a tempura fried lobster.
And I'd never had lobster that way, and I kind of chuckled. I'm like, oh, man, what's he going to do with the lobster? And I couldn't believe it. The flavor was unbelievable. He might be able to tell you a little more about what we did that day.
It was a real simple batter. It was rice flour, a little bit of cornstarch, and we whisked in soda water. So real simple, you know, battered lobster. But when you fry it, it gets ultra crispy, and you get that beautiful light fry on it. And with this sweet, tender lobster meat on the inside, it kind of just was like a no-brainer, like little popcorn nuggets of delicious fried lobster. We served it with like a chive mayonnaise, and I dusted it with a dried black lime. So we had a little fun with flavors and did something. But essentially, I mean, it's acidity, it's a creamy, fatty aioli, and delicious fried sweet lobster. And we ate it with a nice salad with avocados and tomatoes and fun stuff. But it was an amazing meal because we ate right literally on the harbor. Like, we're right there.
I mean, you couldn't beat the place we had. We watched the sunset over the harbor. We ate the product that we worked so hard to catch that day.
Yeah.
And Jimmy had quite the experience up there in Maine. Hopefully we'll have him back again soon.
I'm curious to know, Jimmy, if you would ever do this in Chicago, and Chris, if you do it, it's sort of traditional like Maine, like clam bake, lobster bake on the beach. I mean, I have memories as a kid of at least once a year, we would always go out, you know, below the high tide line, we'd dig a hole, build a fire in there, let the coals get hot, and cover it in seaweed, and then pack lobsters, clams, corn in there, and then cover it and leave it under there. Basically, we would start as the tide was going out, and you had to kind of like get it all out of there before the tide got back up to extinguish the fire.
Right. So I had told Jimmy when he comes back to visit, hopefully we can do that, you know, put the potatoes and the clams and the corn and mussels or whatever and the lobster on top.
Yeah.
And I think that'd give him a little bit more of the main experience as well. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, you know, then it really, and it is sort of, you know, again, it's that thing I was talking about earlier where, you know, there's the fine dining high-end side of like lobster ravioli.
Right.
Like, these things you can do with this decadent, you know, expensive product, because it is expensive, right? There's a lot that goes into catching it. There's a lot that goes into working with it as a chef. It doesn't show up ready.
Right. Absolutely.
It doesn't show up ready to plate. You know, but then on the other side of that, there is such an incredible, like, value to the rustic opportunity of like eating it and taking it apart yourself with your hands. And
are you really enjoying the lobster if you're not wearing it?
Right.
I mean, the juice dripping off your elbows. I mean, that's the part of the fun of eating it the traditional way.
Yeah.
And getting out. And
for me, creating a dish in the restaurant, you know, for instance, it's a finer restaurant. The goal is to make food in the restaurant that people aren't going to make at home, but also ultra exciting. So when I create a dish in the restaurant, it has to be all of these elements that come together to make something beautiful and special and unique. But to sit on a beach and eat a lobster out of the shell like that, or do something, it's the quintessential way. It's an expression of time and place.
Yep.
You know, so it's to experience that versus coming into my restaurant in the middle of Chicago, smack dab in the center of the country.
Yeah.
You know, it's two separate things, but you still get that experience, right? That feeling of the product and not understanding where it came from. So,
yeah. So, you know, I mean, obviously in the restaurant world, we've seen an explosion in the number of restaurants and chefs and people talking about these ingredients. Chris, in the lobsterman world, have you seen, I mean, are there more lobstermen than there were when you were a kid? Are there fewer? How is the industry?
So in order to get into the Maine fishery as a lobsterman, it's a little bit of a challenge. So I started when I was young. We have an apprenticeship program. When you're under the age of 18, you get a student license. You can fish with the first year at being about 10 or 12 years old, I can't remember the exact age, you can have 10 traps and then 50 traps and then up to 150. And once you complete the apprenticeship program, you become eligible to get a commercial lobster license. And if you're over the age of 18, you have to go on a waiting list. So there's only a certain number of fishermen in the state. I can't recall it off the top of my head. Around, I want to say about 6,000, I think, but that could be way off. So there's probably a few less fishermen now than there was when I was a kid. Like a 3-to-1, 5-to-1 ratio of lobster licenses go out before another one come in.
I see.
The student license program was to protect heritage and that families could stay in the fishery. So if my son or daughter wanted to fish, they had a little bit better chance of getting into the industry. And having completed their apprenticeship program, they were rewarded with a commercial lobster license of 300 traps, and then every year they could build up 100 until they got to 800.
Okay.
So it goes back to the sustainability as well. We're not overfishing them because we're not, you know, it's not increased effort. It's a little bit of maybe decreased effort, which is also not hurting our stock and our numbers every year.
Yeah. Do you see, I mean, are there other pressures on the fishery? I know having eaten lobsters last summer in Rhode Island, the lobsters had these weird like pock marks on them that I'd never seen before. And I looked it up and it is a disease that is further south, as far as I understand it. It's currently in the kind of Long Island Sound area, but is that something that is moving north? And my understanding, I forget what it was called, but my understanding of it was it doesn't affect the meat at all.
It doesn't affect the meat at all, and it's also not transferable from what I understand. Hmm. So, and if a lobster can shed his shell or her shell before it gets, it eventually might kill them, but if they can shed their shell before that, they can actually get away from it.
Yeah, it's a bacteria or something?
I don't know a lot about it. We see very little of it. Usually in the spring, if we're going to see it, we see a little bit. But it doesn't affect the meat. It doesn't affect the lobster once he's shed.
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, it's in the back of our mind as a potential problem.
Sure.
I don't know what the biologists and scientists are doing to maybe curb it.
Yeah.
But it is something that's in the back of our mind that we have to worry about and things like that. But as long as we can maintain what we're doing and say, you know, keep the stock healthy, things should be good for years to come.
So I want to talk a little bit from, you know, hear from each of you about, you know, so someone who is not in Maine, who can't go down to the dock and meet Chris, you know, 2 p.m. and get some lobsters from him. What is, as a consumer, what are things to look for? Because, you know, I imagine, especially with a live animal, that there are places that are going to do a better job of moving that around the country and distributing it, and places that are going to do not a great job. And, you know, obviously there's a lot known and written about stress on live animals that we're then going to eat. So what are things you can do if you're going to go to a store and buy a lobster? Let's say you're in somewhere like Chicago, but you see them in the tank. What should you look for?
So you want them to be alive.
Yep.
That's kind of a big deal.
Right.
But as long as they're kept cool, they're a really interesting creature. They can live out of the water for an extraordinary amount of time, as long as they're kept in the proper temperatures. I mean, any animal, if you're expressed to an over amount of heat, is not good for you.
Yeah.
No different than with us. But if they're kept in a cool area, they'll last up to days out of the water. So as long as they're kept cool, once you buy them, they'll be okay. Or they're really fine. But things to look for is just make sure, you know, the tank's clean when you're buying them. And it's no different than a fish market shouldn't smell terribly like fish when you buy fish.
Right.
I mean, that's just how you buy fish.
Yeah.
But as long as they're alive and they look pretty healthy and they're moving around in good shape and the water was cold where they took them out of, if you keep them cool, you can put them in the crisper drawer in your refrigerator and they'll last a couple of days. So, and that's pretty much the only thing I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, and I mean, I definitely would encourage people, if you have never cooked lobster at home, to do it, right? I mean, it's not that hard. Right?
It's not that hard at all. And the thing is, obviously, if you're going to get a live lobster at your local grocery store, they have a tank there. You probably want to pick that lobster out the day you're going to cook it. I mean, it will last, literally. I mean, we get them at the restaurant sometimes, and they'll come in, and you keep them covered with seaweed or newspaper in that cooler, and they're alive 2 days later still.
Sure.
But nonetheless, cooking them that day is super important. And as far as for cooking the lobster, there's endless techniques that you could apply to cooking it at home. So,
yeah.
Well, one thing we tell people, and I get this sometimes, people will be like, I don't know what I did wrong. I killed the lobsters. And I said, well, what'd you do? They said, well, I put them in water.
Right.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that they're breathing the oxygen in the water, and once the oxygen's gone, there's nothing left for them.
Yeah.
Also, the other thing is they can't live in freshwater. So people cover them in ice in a cooler, and then and the then ice will melt, and they'll be in freshwater, and they're no longer living when you go to get them. So that's a kind of a funny thing a lot of us from home we joke about. They're like, man, people just don't get it.
Yep.
But what it is they just haven't been educated on it. And we try to express that. What do we do with them until we get home? Just keep them cool, but don't put them in water. Yeah. So.
And I definitely recommend, so if you're going to steam them, which as we talked about earlier is sort of the classic easiest way to cook a lobster, steam them until the shell turns that uniform, like orange red, and then save the shells is like the number one thing I would tell people is that like once you've picked all the meat out, whether you're picking them out to use them in a ravioli or make lobster rolls or whether you're just going to eat them, save all those shells and put them back into that water you steamed them in because they make a delicious stock. I mean, they just do.
Like, oh, yeah.
I mean, even if you don't have any meat left, I mean, if you use that stock as a base for a chowder, for even for like a corn chowder, I mean,
it's amazing. It's amazingly rich. All the flavor you get out of there is second to none. So,
yeah. Well, thank you guys. It's been a real pleasure having you on Feast Your Ears today. I want to make sure to mention, if you're in Chicago, check out Belmore. BelmoreChicago.com is where Jimmy is cooking. You can follow him on Instagram at Jimmy Papadop.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And on Twitter at jpapa24.
Correct.
You can follow what Chris is up to at @FV_foolishpride. That's fishing vessel foolish pride. So that's Chris's boat. And you can also look at lobsterformaine.com for more information about the fishery and information on how to cook it. Do you guys have anything else you want to mention? Anything else that you've got coming up related to lobsters? I assume, Chris, you've got to get back to fishing.
So. Well, yeah, I'm here till tomorrow. We'll get back to work Wednesday. Cool. We'll get back into full swing. But a lot of people probably know why Jimmy Papadop is his Instagram. But mine's named after my lobster boat, which when I was a kid, my grandfather used to tell me all the time my foolish pride was going to get the best of me. So having him being a big influencer in my life, when I got this boat, I said no better way to tribute than to kind of give it a little bit of his twist. So foolish pride was how I came up with that name.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys again so much. Thank you for bringing the lobster to taste. It was delicious.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Don't forget to head over to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and support this and all the other great shows here on Heritage Radio Network. Check out sumostew.com. And if you miss this one, we have a sumo stew every other month. There are 6 sumo tournaments every year in Japan, and we have an event here in the States for every single one of them. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows, heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And please take a moment to like the show on any of those platforms. You can reach out to me via email if you have any questions, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. You can follow me on social media @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.